Thank you for the questions. Maybe what we'll do is take a couple here from the notes and then see if there's one in the room also. So one of the ones from the notes. There can be a lot of selfing and othering in caring for the body. For example, I notice a sense of, I eat these kinds of food because my body is this way or because I believe something about these foods. Other people don't do this, so other people are dot, 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 fill in the belief. And there's also a movement to kindly care for the body. The body, heart, mind feels good when I eat this way. Can you speak to these multiple motivations of selfing, preferences, and kindness in our choices? So, in a way, this is speaking in some ways to mixed motivations. That in this particular example, there's in eating certain foods, there's both a motivation to, or perhaps a sense of self or identity around certain choices, but simultaneously a sense of, this is healthy, this feels good to the body, it feels kind to the body to eat this way. So both there together. So this is not a phenomenon that just happens around eating. It happens a lot in so many different experiences where we might notice kind of a sense of wanting or aversion in a choice we're making, and also a sense of compassion in social justice, for instance. There can be a real sense of compassion in taking action. And at times a sense of aversion, anger at the injustice. And so they're both in there. And I think one of the important pieces in looking at mixed motivations is not to have some kind of idea of my motivations have to be completely pure in order to act. Because we'll wait a long time before that's the case. There will be, for instance, especially around social justice, there often will be a sense of anger at the injustice. And yet a genuine wish for the alleviation of suffering. On certain times, we need to act. We see something happening, we need to step in and act, to take care, to express that kindness, that compassion. Sometimes I use the example of, you know, if you're walking down the street with a child and the child sees a puppy dog on the other side of the street and, you know, runs out into the street to go pet the puppy dog and there's a car coming. You know, there's probably fear coming up there, but there's also the compassion of not wanting the child to get hurt. You don't wait and say, oh, there's fear, I shouldn't act on that fear. You need to act to take care of yourself, of others. And this is the way eating is. We're not going to have a kind of a pure motivation necessarily. And yet what's most important here in all of this is noticing that the mixed motivations are there. And so in the question, it's clear that the person who wrote it notices these mixed motivations. So that's supportive. That's useful to notice that there is both this sense of identity or beliefs and views around the eating, and also the sense of care. There's not a need to wait until the the sense of identity falls away in order to feed the body. We need to feed the body and notice when there are those motivations. Notice when those motivations are happening. Not to beat ourselves up for them. They are conditioned. They are not self. They have come about through history, conditioning, and so kind of understanding, recognizing that, yes, that's the way this mind has been shaped. And the recognition of that, the kind, compassionate awareness of the unhelpful motivations or the motivations around selfing, the judgments about others, that the very mindfulness of those begins to help the mind to let go of them. Sometimes it can be useful, or sometimes an exploration here can be when you see mixed motivations coming up in any kind of a situation. You see mixed motivations arising. Let yourself really fully know that both are there. And in terms of taking the action, see if you can connect a little more in the heart, connect a little more to the wholesome motivation. Connect to the wholesome motivation. Be aware of the wholesome motivation. That also strengthens that. It strengthens that sense of care, of kindness, of connection. The other thing that occurred to me as I read this question was the interesting kind of resonance it had for me with respect to the Buddha's own journey. Because he had a belief about food. He had a belief that not eating food would be good for his spiritual growth. And at some point he realized, I'm going to die, and I'm not going to come to the answer to my question. Maybe I need to eat food. Maybe I need to eat the food so that it can support me, nourish me. So that kindness, really recognizing that the motivation that he had been operating under was mistaken. And he began to explore that possibility of, all right, let's see, I'll nourish myself, come back to health. You know, it said that he was so thin that he could touch his stomach and feel his backbone. So he took the time to nourish himself and then to explore experience again, explore what was going on in his body and mind. So that was a kindness to himself, that he nourished himself. So mixed motivations will exist for a very long time in our practice, in our lives. Notice them. Have some compassion for yourself about the fact that they're there. And try to explore the possibility of not being driven by the unwholesome and to connect with the wholesome motivations as we take our actions. You want to add anything, Nisha? Okay. Actually, I think the second question you had actually follows pretty nicely from this one. No, let's see. That one. Yeah. That one. Okay.
This question is, in Vipassana, the goal seems to be to cultivate the grounded and relaxed state of mindfulness. I notice in this practice that I prefer that state of mindfulness to the agitated or distracted states that appear. Could you speak to this? Is this a habit of mind from meditation training? I suspect this is this person is not the only person who has this question. This is a question that comes up a lot, because I think we hear words like ease and allowing and softening, relaxed, and there's a sense that like this is how I should be feeling. Easeful, relaxed. And then we see things like aversion and frustration, fear, wanting, craving. We see all these states that arise in the mind. And then it gets confusing. Like, wait a minute. And I, you know, clearly easeful, relaxed. It sounds better, right? It sounds like, yeah, that's what I want. And this frustration, agony, despair. No, thank you. Don't want that. Yeah. So it can make sense that this is this. There is this preference coming up, and such. And I had this too. I had the same question until. And again, I really think Siyarawati Janiya helped me with this one. And that is maybe like, what do we mean by the mind that is grounded or relaxed? And that's really the meditating mind, right? This awareness. And that awareness can actually be relaxed and grounded with states that are coming up, states that are easeful, states that are tense, states that are pleasant, that are connected with pleasant, states that are connected with unpleasant. All the different states can be known in awareness. And it's this awareness that has this relaxed kind of natural quality to it when it's balanced. Right. So there can be a relaxed, mindful awareness with things that are agitated, a distracted mind. A distracted mind is like this. The knowing of the distracted mind can be relaxed. can be still. An agitated mind is like this. The knowing of that agitated mind can be relaxed, can be still. And one more thing I'll just add. Sierra often starts retreats with, we're here to practice bhavana, meditation, which is also translated as cultivation. And it's the cultivation of wisdom, understanding, the cultivation of the wisdom that moves us in the direction of well-being and freedom from suffering and away from the direction of more suffering. And sometimes that I find helpful to remember, especially when there can be, of course, when it's feeling calm and peaceful, of course, there's a lot of conditioning that makes that preference come about, right? Like, oh yeah, this is good. This is good stuff. I want this to keep going. There's a lot of conditioning in that. And I find it helpful to remember that this is the cultivation of understanding and wisdom, or cultivation of wholesome qualities that lead in the direction of freedom. Because I think it points to something in particular that the Buddha was offering to us. To feel peaceful when things are peaceful and calm is wonderful. But to find a relaxed stillness when things are not calm, the relaxed stillness of knowing when things are not calm, That is a kind of that kind of takes it to another level. It's not just the peace of feeling pleasantness, but there's another kind of layer of peace here that's available, even when things are not seeming pleasant or peaceful or calm. And with that stillness, there's kind of a developing of an understanding about the way things are. And then that understanding releases us into a peace and a freedom and a happiness that does not depend upon conditions. Yeah, that's what's coming to mind here with that question. Thank you for that question. Is there anything you wanted to add?
So a little bit to the part of the question about the habit around, is this a habit around meditation that this idea would happen, or that, I think it is beliefs It's beliefs about what meditation is. And I feel so much like what we're doing here is poking holes, popping little bubbles of beliefs around what meditation is. It's so much broader, bigger than we can imagine. I mean, when Nisha's using Saito's phrase of the meditating mind, I feel like I want to remind everybody that meditating mind doesn't just mean like when we're sitting in meditation or doing formal meditation. That mind is all the time. You know, the taking care or having that quality of being with what is. It's not just in sitting or walking. It's all the time. And this possibility of, you know, what meditation is. I mean, so many of us have the habit of meditation through sitting, through the stillness, through the formal walking. And that comes sometimes with these states where things do get quiet and peaceful. And we get reinforced about that. And that's what we think it's supposed to be, you know. But, and for me also, as with Nisha, Sayadaw really burst this bubble. No, it is not about peace and calm in everything that's happening. It's not even necessarily about always having peace and calm in the mind. But can we know that the mind is not calm and peaceful? It may not feel like the mind that knows that is still, but at least it knows it. And that will head in the direction of that stable mindfulness. That mindfulness that can be with what's happening. And I think what's going on sometimes there is our habit of orienting to the experience or the objects of what's happening rather than what's happening in the mind. It takes some time to step back and recognize, oh yeah, the knowing of the experience, that's actually pretty stable. That's pretty calm. That's pretty easeful. When there's all kinds of stuff going on, it's like the all kinds of stuff going on is so much more obvious that we can't really recognize the calm or the peace. But we might recognize, yeah, I know there's a lot of stuff going on. And over time, we might begin to recognize, oh, that knowing part, that actually feels pretty still. But for me, it wasn't like an instant like shift or to a recognition of, oh, yeah, I know that that stuff's happening. And oh, yeah, I feel the ease and peace in the background. That took a while. I think still, I forget that. But I do trust that the knowing is where it's at. You know, that it does not have to be still or calm. I feel like I've lost that one. You know, that belief is like, yeah, not so much operating anymore. So, yeah, that was what I wanted to add. Barry, do you want to say anything, add anything? Okay. Do you want to say anything more after what I said? No.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
That means well spoken.
Should we take a question from the room? Let's ask, is there any question in the room? I want to also remind the folks, we didn't do this at the beginning. Those of you who are out in the foyer, in the walking room, there is enough room in here. Please join us in here. Especially if you'd like to ask a question. Any questions in the room? Okay. So, next question. How do we stop worrying about what others think of us? Anyone else in that wondering? It's so deep in our system, how we are seemingly organized as human beings to be relational and to care, to think about what other people think about us. Yeah, there's plenty of room, please. So yeah, there's so much in there. And kind of come to the way to work with this, you know, that we notice that we're worrying. We notice the feeling of worrying. And when we are aware of that feeling of worrying, partly the reason we want to stop the worrying is because that feeling of worrying is unpleasant, right? And we don't like the way it feels. But we usually can't simply stop. It's deeply conditioned. It feels like it's not just a conditioning of our own personal lives. You know, we have some conditioning that happens for us is about, you know, things that happened to us personally, what happened on the playground with our, you know, fellow playmates and how that affected me growing up. And so there's some of that kind of conditioning in each of us, and there's conditioning around our families and things like that. This conditioning around thinking about what others think of us and having that be important, that seems to be human. It's pretty deeply conditioned in there. So probably not something we can just say, oh, I'm going to stop doing that. It is conditioned, though. It's not, I would say, the worrying part, the part that feels like, oh, it's not okay that I don't know what somebody thinks about me, or, you know, I need to find out what they think about. That worrying part, the neediness part around it, is not necessary. It may be that as human beings, we need to have a kind of a relational experience where we kind of come together and have a sense of who we are, and, you know, that, and we are kind of different beings, you know, in a way. It's so interesting to watch how our sense of self changes in dependence on who we're standing in front of. There's a kind of it's not just me. It's me in relationship to somebody else. And so there's this we, or this kind of feeling of who I am as a person that is related to this other person. And I think this is some of why we care, you know, some of why we care about what other people think about us. The worrying part, the part that feels like it's not okay, it's like we want to control what other people think about us. We want them to think something about us that we want them to think about us. So that piece is uncontrollable. You know, we're not going to be able to control what other people think about us. So we do need to kind of find a way to open to what is happening for us with our relationships. So this quality, basically comes back to the same instruction over and over again. You notice the worrying. You're not going to be able to stop it. Can be useful to recognize that. I mean, there's so many things in our minds that we feel like it's a flaw in me that I can't make this stop happening. It's a problem that I can't control my mind so that I'm not worrying about things. Sometimes I look in my own mind, it's like, well, can I stop this? No. And why is that? Because it's not self. The Buddha pointed to that really directly. He said, you know, mental formations are not self. Mental formations includes the whole host of emotions, thoughts, beliefs, views. Worrying would be one of those. So we can put worrying in the sentence. Worrying is not self. If worrying were self, one would be able to say of worrying, may worrying be thus, may worrying not be thus. But worrying is not self. So it is not possible to say of worrying be thus, may worrying not be thus. So it's a not self teaching. So that to me is, it's like that's helpful. So I can't stop it, but I can know it's conditioned. I can know its experience. I can know the experience of worrying. And the way the practice works, you know, worrying arises. If we are not mindful of it and caught in the belief of worrying, it's important that I know this. It's important that this person think this thing about me. If I'm caught in the belief of that, and acting on that, then I'm just reinforcing that belief, that view. You know, we get a little bit of relief if we figure out what somebody's thinking about us and it's in alignment with what we're thinking about ourselves. I feel, oh, okay, I'm in control. I've got this. So we get a little bit of relief, and that reinforces that worrying is the way to go. We're willing to keep worrying and feel that bad feeling because we think that that worrying then gives us a little bit of relief when we get that hit of, oh, I figured something out. So that's how non-mindfulness allows that pattern to just perpetuate. It just reinforces itself. When we're mindful of it, we feel the worrying. We feel the suffering of the worrying. When we're caught in the belief of the worrying, we think that the worrying is going to get us to the other side of worrying. If I worry about this thing enough, I'll figure out how to fix or change or control the situation. So caught in that belief of worrying, we think that's what we need to do. When we, and the piece of that, when we're caught in that belief of worrying, we don't see, what we don't see there is that it is the worrying that is the painful experience, the worrying itself. We don't see that part. We just see that if I follow that worrying, then I'll come to the other side of it. And so with the mindfulness, we open to the experience. This is what worrying feels like. Almost immediately, you're going to recognize, wow, that doesn't feel very good. the beliefs will try to kick up. The beliefs will kind of come in and say, you need to follow through on this. You know, worrying knows how to get to the other side of this. What worrying won't tell you is that if worrying could release, there would not be the problem. There would not be the issue, the thing worried about. There may still be a need or a kind of a discernment of this could be useful, this could be not useful, but that kind of agitated quality of the mind does not need to be there. So the mindfulness, the awareness of the worrying, and this can replace pretty much any mental state in there, any unhelpful mental state. We begin to feel the suffering of that. We feel the suffering of that state. And our system understands, with mindfulness, the mindfulness and the wisdom together begin to recognize that this experience is not the way to well-being. So the worrying has the belief in it that I'm the way to well-being. If you follow me, you'll find your way to well-being. But the mindfulness of the worrying gives you direct, immediate feedback. This is not the way to well-being. It's immediately in this moment, not well-being. How could this lead to well-being following on this feeling, doing what this feeling is telling me? That is what mindfulness and wisdom understand as they meet these unhelpful mind states. And our system, what I'd say kind of is our system inherently, our human system wants to move in the direction of well-being. And so when it sees, when our system, when our human system has the information, is getting the education, we could say, getting the education about what this worrying actually is, it will begin to find its way to let go of it. We cannot figure out how to let go of it. That's that not self nature of it. Yeah, if I could let go of this, so many times I remember sitting in the meditation hall experiencing something excruciating, saying, I'd let go of this if I knew how. We don't know how to let go, but what we can experience, what we can explore is the awareness of it and the trust, the patience that that awareness is helping the mind to understand what is suffering. And the natural movement of the mind to move towards well-being will find its way to let go of that. We can't figure it out. Our system knows how to figure out how to let go of these things when it gets the information about what's helpful and what's not helpful. That's the trust that we have to step into in this practice. It's not a very obvious kind of thing to trust. I'll just say one more piece about worrying. I mean, just that state of mind. You know, you can be with states, and we've talked about this a little bit, you know, just noticing, okay, this is what it's like to feel worrying happening. And that itself will, over time, be help the mind to let go of the worrying. And there can be a little bit more exploration or interest too. What else is happening with that worrying? It's not just worrying. There's something else going on. We all worry. We all have different things that kind of motivate that worry. So what's connected to that worry? Is it wanting to be loved? Is it loneliness? Confusion or fear? So what's connected to it? Worrying often is kind of manifesting in a thought kind of state, agitation is the feeling of it, kind of an agitated energy. But there's something else with it. So that question, what else is happening with this? Or maybe the question, what's being believed related to this worry? Those can help the mind to begin to see a little more clearly what's happening with that. But we don't stop the worrying. What is revealed through mindfulness and wisdom will move us in the direction, will help support the mind to let go of it. The mind will begin to let go of it. Want to add anything?
Okay. The next question is, how can we move from awareness/curiosity about self-judgment to a state of less suffering? One of the things that's coming up in my mind is like, you could probably replace self-judgment for worrying in what Andrea just shared. And I think that gets us to the answer to this question. But maybe I'll just share my own experience with this. I remember a time on retreat where there was some mindfulness available, and what I had noticed was an experience that I found mortifying. There was so much shame that this was coming up in my experience. And then, you know, it was time to go meet with the teacher and report about what's going on in the practice. And I remember sharing it with my teacher. And just like, you know, I had enough clarity to know that I need to just say what's happening to get some help with this. And I went in with like, oh my goodness, this is what is coming up in my mind. Like, I can't believe it. You know, this is horrible. Help. And the way the teacher responded was, yeah, okay, that's arising in the mind. And that was so different than the way I was responding to that seeing of that, that it kind of shook me up. Like, it shook me up in a way that was really, it confused me in a way that was actually really helpful. Then it was like, oh, is that, okay, this is being known, that's it? That's like, that's it? And I got to see this kind of external example of somebody who was like, okay, yep, that's arising in the mind. And it's not like that meant that that kind of thought wasn't coming up anymore. And it didn't even mean that my reaction to it wasn't coming up anymore. It would still, like, it would come up and there would be this, like, ugh, cringe. Like, ugh, that again. Ugh, that again. That kind of cringe would happen. But there was also a way in which, because there's this cultivation of that that mindfulness over and over again, okay, right now it's like this. Okay, right now it's like this.
And those gaps between the dots were getting a little closer. And so there was even a, kind of being able to hang out with that experience a little bit to see it pass away. And then, again, it would pop up somewhere, the original thought, and then the shame about the thought. All of this, you know, right now it's like this. Okay, shame. Right now it's like this. And then again, it would sort of do its thing and pass away. And I don't know exactly when something started being understood somewhere along the way, that this is kind of just, it's just happening, and then it's going away. And then it happens again, and then it goes away. And that was just interesting. Like, what? Who's doing this? And then what I also thought was really, what my mind started doing was it was getting more interested in it. It's almost like the interest was getting stronger and the shame was kind of beginning to sort of, feel less charged. Just the interest was like, oh, okay. Shame is like this and it's going up and down. And then noticing like when it would come up, like the mind just got interested in that. Like when the original thought that would lead to the shame would come up. So like, what's going on that when this thought is coming up? And so slowly, it just started happening that the mind was getting more and more interested and less charged around what it was seeing. And then again, gradually, the way that Andrea talked about the gradual path, the way that Ari was pointing to those beautiful images that the Buddha offers about how it's just like really slow, this boat with its rigging, it's on the ocean for 6 months, and then it's, the rope is, you know, in the sand, and it's, there's wind and there's sun, and then slowly that rope starts to disintegrate over time. That rope that's kind of like that tie, and it felt that way, that over, like slowly over time, the charge was going down with the self-judgment. So it wasn't so much that, like, you know, the awareness is here and then the less suffering was something I was moving towards, but it was that the awareness was there all along and the suffering to less suffering was shifting in that kind of way. Yeah, so I thought I'd offer that in case anybody else is experiencing something like this. Yeah, it's kind of, it's humbling and amazing that this can happen. Wanted to add, Ari.
So there's about 7 minutes left, and there were some questions that were not so much practice related that we'll cover. We'll come to. We'll respond to them at the end of the retreat. So those of you who wrote questions that were not so much connected right to the practice, we'll get to those questions. And this one isn't so much about the practice, but it's a kind of a conceptual question that can be useful to articulate a little bit. So I'll just say a few words about this question. Can you just discuss the difference, distinction between awareness and consciousness? So these two words in the Buddhist teaching, they're referring to two particular functions of the mind that the Buddha spoke to. Awareness is mindfulness, and consciousness is the knowing function of our minds. Every single moment, every single sense impression that happens, there's a knowing. That quality of knowing a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, something going on in the mind. Whether or not we are mindful of it, knowing happens every single moment. It's arising and passing. It's not a stable awareness. It's not stable knowing. It's a knowing that happens, a sight. There's a sense object, there's seeing, and then there's the sight that happens. There's the knowing of that sight. There's hearing, there's a knowing of a hearing. There's a smelling and a knowing of the smelling. There's a body sensation and a knowing of that. So or something going on in the mind and the knowing of that. So the knowing is just this really basic functioning of contact with the senses. We've been contacted by something. And that goes on while we're alive, moment after moment, every moment, a new consciousness, a new sense object, a new consciousness, a new sense object. So it's just like moment after moment, we're getting contact and a knowing. Mindfulness is kind of more of an activity of mind. It's this capacity to be aware that we're aware. And we know, we can see, actually, that it comes and goes. It's not happening in every single mind moment. And we know this. We know this distinction, actually. I think many of us have had a kind of an experience like what I'm getting ready to describe. This was one where it was just so blindingly clear to me that it really sticks out. I was driving to IMC to offer a class, and I was coming in an unusual way for some reason. I was driving in an unusual way, so I was a little more aware than usual, actually. I was quite aware of where I was and conscious of, you know, oh, I have to turn left at the next light and that kind of thing. So I was pretty aware. And then some thought came into my mind and I was gone. And the next thing I remember, I was probably three stoplights down the road. I had not turned left at the stoplight. It was probably within the space of 2 seconds after I had that thought, oh, I need to turn left at the next stoplight, that the mind got caught by a thought. And I found myself at another stoplight, you know, quarter of a mile down the road, having missed my turn. And I came into consciousness. I came into awareness. Mindfulness returned while I was sitting at this stoplight. And I was like, wow, mindfulness is back. You know, it was one of those times where mindfulness had gotten so lost, you know, I had no memory. And often when mindfulness gets lost and come back, there's some memory of what had been happening, right? You know, you can kind of remember. I had one experience that happened where I could see that I was kind of lost in thought about stuff and people coming and going in the room. And then my mindfulness came back and it's like, yeah, mindfulness is back, but I still remember what had been happening there. But in this case, I had zero recollection of having been driving. It was kind of scary. You know, it's kind of one of those things that's like, how did I get here? And yet, I was stopped at a stoplight. I had not just gone right through a stoplight. I had not, like, swerved off the road. Something had been seeing and hearing and perceiving, recognizing, knowing that sense experience. That consciousness, feeling, perception, all of that, the recognition of red stoplight, that had happened. I was not aware of it at all. So that was a kind of a real kind of recognition of consciousness, feeling, perception. Yeah, they're going on. They are continuing. Mindfulness comes and goes. They are not, they're definitely not the same thing. So we can begin to know that difference, just like, okay, so awareness, mindfulness is something that lets us recognize what's happening in the present moment. Now, there's a little bit of a conflation sometimes because mindfulness uses consciousness, feeling, perception to recognize, it's what I think of sometimes is like mindfulness is consciousness, feeling, and perception, recognizing consciousness, feeling, and perception and body and stuff going on in the mind. But it is not, it's what is called mindfulness is a mental formation. So it is not, a little further in the question, it's a awareness, is awareness dependable, unlike consciousness? We can see from this, you know, awareness is mindfulness, you know, it comes and goes, it is not dependable. The wise mindfulness that we're cultivating is a wholesome quality of mind that can become more stable over time. But it is a mental formation. And so like worrying, I just expressed that phrase that the Buddha said about mental formations. I'll say it again with mindfulness. Mindfulness is not self. If mindfulness were self, it would be possible to say of mindfulness, may mindfulness be thus. May mindfulness not be thus. Wouldn't that be nice? May I be continuously mindful. But mindfulness is not self. So it's not possible to say that of mindfulness. And yet, there is this movement in the direction, you know, what we were talking about just a few moments ago, the movement of the mind towards the wholesome. When this capacity of mindfulness is active, we are getting the information about what's wholesome and what's unwholesome in the moment, and our mind begins to move more and more towards the wholesome. And so mindfulness included, that wholesome quality of mindfulness, there's like this organic almost pull in that direction as mindfulness is cultivated. There's more and more of a kind of a recognition of the value of that, and so it's the mind moves in that direction. And my understanding is that freedom in a free mind, greed, aversion, and delusion are not present. And this capacity of wise mindfulness is arising in every moment. But it is still a phenomenon that is coming and going. Still that. So we should stop. We're a little bit over time, so don't we just sit in silence for a few seconds, and Nisha will ring the bell in a few moments.